When you see on your program that I'm to speak on the subject of culture shock, you may expect that what I would normally do is look at the Bible and find various references there so that we can see a biblical perspective on what this issue is. The Bible does in fact have things to say about it. However, because this is a missionary rally and various people have been asked to speak on different topics, and there will be at the end a challenge from the scriptures, I have therefore decided that what I'm going to do is just look at the practical aspects of this issue, culture shock. It's an expression that is used quite a lot these days, sometimes in a very superficial sense, with people talking about overseas travel and things like that. But when we first went out as missionaries in 1965, we went to Bangkok in Thailand, we had never heard the expression culture shock. And so of course we didn't get it. We just went there and thought, well, it's going to be tough, it's going to be different, let's get in, learn the language, and commit ourselves to doing what we've come here for. It wasn't until we started language school and we met other missionaries from other countries, and they were with various missions, we heard that they had had training and cultural lectures about this thing. That was the first time we heard it. People were talking to each other and saying, have you got it yet? Oh, I got culture shock. No, I haven't felt anything yet. As if they're waiting for a heart attack or getting the measles or something like that. We just went about doing what we're supposed to do. Looking back, yes, there was some culture shock. Well, so be it. You just go about doing what you have to do. We didn't expect it was going to be easy, and it wasn't easy. Thailand in those days was very much a third world country. Bangkok was not the gleaming metropolis of 12 or 13 million people that it is today. It was still a large city of 1.5 to 2 million people, but no building was more than 3 stories high. Where we lived was in a very rough area, a slum in a way. It was tough going. But as I say, we didn't expect it to be otherwise. We didn't go there expecting that we were going to have all the mod cons that we have in Australia. We were very thankful for a missionary from South Thailand. He had been a missionary in China for 10 years before I was even born. That's how long he'd been around. And when they got expelled from China, they came to Thailand. He came to Bangkok and helped us through the routines of immigration and other things. He managed to introduce us to one Thai person who could speak some English. But once he got us into our house and showed us the ropes, he then took off back for his home and he said, well, you've got the Lord up above, you've got your head on your shoulders, you'll be okay. It's a bit of a rough way of going about it, but it wasn't all that far wrong. There's a lot of truth in that. Now, we had to start language school the next day. We had one child of 2.5, another one who was only about 10 months old. But this Thai man that we just referred to, he found someone who could be a babysitter while we went to language school, but she couldn't speak any English either. And so there we were, just knowing one person who could speak a little English, and we didn't even know where he lived, and off we go to language school, and we start from scratch. We'd settled in for the long haul. We were going to make sure that we were there long enough to really let the language and the culture and other things sink in before we even thought about leaving the country. The language is so important because it's through the language you understand a culture, and it's through a culture you understand the language. The two are inseparably bound. I'm not saying you won't learn anything about a culture if you don't know the language, but there will be a limit as to how effective your knowledge really is. Now, I was a bit extreme, I admit. For the first 12 months, I was determined to become so brainwashed in the language that I could live, eat, drink, sleep, think, do everything in the Thai language. The only English I read for the first 12 months was my Bible, and of course correspondence at home and back again. In the house we spoke English as a family, of course, but apart from that, nothing. We didn't go to any English fellowships. We wanted to become totally immersed, and I tell you, it paid off. One of the other things that our senior missionary colleague said was, when you first come here, he said, you'll be fascinated with things. You'll find it just so different. And it was. We had never been outside Australia up until then. In fact, 95% of Australians had probably never been outside the country in those days. We went by ship because it was still cheaper to travel by ship than by plane. And we were fascinated. We'd never been in a country where idolatry was rampant and pagan religions were all around. To see all of this in front of you, it certainly was just a totally different world. But the man was right when he said, after a while, it'll get you down. And after a while, it does start to get you down. You see people blinded by idolatry and paganism. How is the light of the gospel going to penetrate? Then as you start to feel frustrated and you see these elements of the religion affecting the culture, a whole lot of cultural practices that are wrong, you see what the religion has done to people, enslaved people. You get frustrated. And then you start to think of home. And you think of how good it was back home. Become rather idealistic. So don't complain when you get people from other countries coming here, and after they've been here a while, they start to think about home. Back home, it was much better. But then when you do get back home, you find that your picture of home was rather idealistic. We came home and we heard people complaining about something here and something there. And we thought, what on earth are you complaining about? This country is like utopia compared with where we've just come from. But we're only home a couple of months and then we find ourselves complaining also. It's amazing how quickly you forget. We expect more when the circumstances are better and then we complain when we don't get what we want. Coming back to Thailand, the things that helped us were prayer and common sense. We had a deep commitment to what we were doing. We didn't expect things to be easy, they weren't easy, but we were determined to get through it and to do what we were going to do to become effective in the Lord's work. Some helpful Thai people, they also played a big part. But above all, we had a passionate desire to learn. To learn the language, to learn the culture, to learn how people thought. Not to go there to impose our ideas upon other people, but to learn and see what makes this place tick. One of the problems we have, coming from a country like this, is to assume that our own culture is okay, and we're going into an inferior culture. That is not the case. There are plenty of things in our culture that are much worse than some of the things you meet in some of these other cultures. Then again, there are things in those other cultures that are worse than what we have in ours. No culture is perfect. They all need redemption. They all need salvation. The problem with our own culture is that we don't see it. It's like your accent. Most Australians don't think they've got an accent, but everybody else in the world knows that they have. But those people in other parts of the world, they don't think they've got an accent either. They don't hear their accent because it's part of them. So it is with culture. We don't see it because it's part of us. And you've got to somehow get outside it to see more objectively what it is. When we went to Thailand, we had to rethink everything. We went from a fairly active Christian background here, and the tendency would be to simply do the same kinds of things over there. For example, Sunday schools, gospel meetings, or whatever it might be. But then as I looked at the Bible, I found there were no Sunday schools in the Bible. There were no gospel meetings in the Bible. Incidentally, I said that once to somebody, and he got upset. He said, "You look at the church in Thessalonica, from then sounded out the word of God." I said, yeah, I'm not saying they didn't preach the gospel. I said there were no gospel meetings. That is, at 7 o'clock on Sunday night, you come into a purpose-built building, you sing out of a certain hymn book, a certain number of songs, then you have a prayer. People come in, they listen to a sermon, and then you close with hymn and prayer, and they go home. I said, that kind of thing is not in the Bible. The problem is, we argue about the procedural aspects, and we miss the important things. For example, you're supposed to pray, you're supposed to worship, you're supposed to teach the Bible. But exactly how you do it, or how you arrange your seats, or what sort of a building you have, or what time you start, or what time you close, how many hymns, how many prayers, when you do the Bible readings, all of those kinds of things, there's not a word about it in the Bible as to how the particular meeting or service ought to be structured. Sunday school, or boys' club, girls' club, women's meetings, men's meetings, youth camps, you name it. Those things that we are so familiar with, we got over there and we thought, well, none of these things are in the Bible. What did they do in the Bible? Well, it seems to me that what they did, they went out and they witnessed to the truth of the gospel. They spread the gospel by word of mouth. They talked to other people. They shared the Bible. And one way or another, people became believers. What I'm saying is, we have to somehow separate the basic truth from the cultural package it comes in. The basic truth is we must make the gospel known. The cultural package it comes in is the particular form of church service that we might have. I'm speaking of our own country here now. The main thing is not the particular form of service, but the proclamation of the gospel. One could go on about this: marriage, funerals, weddings, things like that. They are occasions when cultural practices come to the fore. There's nothing particularly Christian about the way we conduct, let us say, a marriage service, the way you dress and things of that nature. Even the way we get our marriage partner. We mostly choose our own in this country. But you go to other countries where their parents choose the partner for them. Now, there's nothing in the Bible about how you get your marriage partner. But there's a lot in the Bible about how you behave towards your marriage partner. And that is the important issue. You have to rub along with different practices in different countries, coming back to what the Bible talks about, and that is how husbands and wives behave towards each other and towards their children. We could go on with a whole lot of other examples. After many years in Thailand, my ministry expanded into other countries. I can remember when I first went into a couple of Pacific Island nations, and then later on into Africa, into Eastern Europe, into other parts. But I can remember distinctly going to Papua New Guinea, and then later to the Solomon Islands, and thinking to myself, I've spent all these years in Asia, I know a bit about cross-cultural mission, and I'm oriented towards the thinking of the people in these countries. But when I got there, I found really I had to start all over again. A totally different culture in the Pacific Islands region from what we were accustomed to in Thailand. Then when I went to Africa, I got some rude awakenings right at the very beginning. Just a simple thing like taking photos. Who ever thought that there was anything wrong with taking a photo in a public place? Just taking a photo down the street. The very first time I did it, and the first city I ever arrived at in Africa, I got arrested. Well, I was released after 20 minutes of haggling. They wanted to confiscate my camera and destroy the film and do all sorts of other horrible things. It never occurred to me that it was wrong, unacceptable, to take photos of people or take photos down the main street of traffic or buildings or whatever it happened to be. Church seating. Now, I've met this in a number of countries where the men and the women sit on different sides of the church. I thought, well, where did this come from? Because it really annoys me that a family cannot sit together in church. Of all the places where the family should be together, surely it ought to be in church. And then you go to some of these places and you see there's a separation. So in a number of countries I've asked them, is this a cultural thing? And without exception, I've found that it is not a cultural thing. I don't know where it came from. I suspect it came from early missionaries who started this practice and now it's been passed on. And I must tell you that some people cross land and sea to make a proselyte and they become worse than the people who made them that in the first place. More traditional and more set in their ways. Hard to budge them. And so traditions can take an authority upon themselves that they don't deserve. So I ask people quite often, why do you have this in church? And they say, well, it's always been that way and that was the way it was. I said, if you go to a function at school and the parents all come along, do the males sit on one side and the females on the other? They say, no. I said, if you go to a cinema, do all the men sit on one side and the women on another? No. If you go to a football match, if you go to all sorts of places where there are public congregations of people, or in formal meetings of one kind or another, doesn't matter whether it's a secular one, a school one, a church one, do all the men sit on one side and the women on another? And they say no. The only place they do it is in church. I'm pleased to say that I've met Christians in some of these countries who are trying to change it and mix things up, and it's not that way in every country anyway, but people hide behind culture. It's not a cultural thing at all. It's simply a tradition. We've got to be careful that we don't give culture a higher value than it deserves. And we're not to make culture an excuse for simply carrying out our own practices or our own traditions. I could get into dress codes here too, but I don't think I'll digress too far there. It just seems to me so anomalous to see people in frightfully hot countries, men clothed in dark suits and ties, and you think, what is going on here? But then you find that some of the traditions that they've inherited from the West are practiced not only in the church, but they're practiced in other public places as well. Then you go to other countries where people are far more attuned to the local cultural dress modes, and so they're not hung up thinking that you've got to dress in a three-piece suit in order to be a respectable citizen. Well, those sorts of things are many and varied. A few things that you've got to be very careful about. Now, in Thailand, males and females don't touch each other in public. All the years we lived in Thailand, I think I can probably honestly say I never touched a woman. You don't shake hands. You don't do the kinds of things that are natural for us. You even go to the airport, and parents will be sending off a child overseas to study, and there's all this, you know, bowing, and they put their hands together like this, and say their fond farewells. No hugs or kisses. Other countries you go to, they kiss quite frequently. You go to some of the European countries, you get at one side, then you get two sides. Sometimes you get at one, two, one, left, right, left. Then you go to Africa, you get lots of hugs. Now, some of these things I find good, like the hugging bit in Africa, I find quite appealing. The kissing thing doesn't grab me all that much. Mind you, they don't actually kiss you on the cheek. They actually kiss the air beside your cheek. But you go through the routine. However, in those Southeast Asian countries, the Buddhist countries that I'm referring to, Thailand and some of its neighbours, never would you see that kind of thing. I was shocked when we had a person from one of those countries in our place here in Brisbane. Someone greeted them and just automatically went up and kissed the woman. She nearly fell over with fright. And I thought, goodness me, how insensitive can you be? But the person wasn't aware of it. They just thought everybody does this. You've got to be very careful about those kinds of things. Even holding hands. Gay and I never would walk down the street in Thailand holding hands. That was simply not done. However, you will find men holding hands, or you'll find women holding hands. You see two policemen walking down the road holding hands, and you start to think, what's going on here? Well, don't think anything bad is happening. That is a cultural thing. I'll meet some of these fellows sometimes and say, oh, hello, and I'll start talking away, and he'll be standing there holding my hand, and I'm sort of shutting my eyes and thinking, when's he going to release me? We feel uncomfortable with some of these things, but they don't. One of my golden rules was, when I'd go to a country, to hang back as much as possible and to see what the locals are doing, and then to copy them as best I can, or to ask questions about what is acceptable and what is not. They, in Thailand, used to accuse us of being impolite because we didn't follow some of their traditions. But then we think they are impolite because of some of the things they do. Now, Thais have a whole lot of cultural hang-ups about demeanour and deportment and use of various limbs, the hands and feet and things like that, which in English we don't worry too much about. And so they think we're impolite because we look a bit uncouth in not conforming to those things. Mind you, if we're permanent residents there, we ought to conform. But I'm speaking of tourists and other people who come in and behave in a way that the local people might find offensive. When you've been there a while and you're talking to the local Christians about all these things, and they say, oh, foreigners are impolite, but Thais are very polite. And I say, but you're looking from our point of view, you people are very impolite. And then they get quite taken aback by this. I said, well, all the questions you ask, they're always asking personal questions. They have a fascination with toilet procedures, sexual procedures, and how much you pay for everything. And they're always asking questions. And I said, well, we find that embarrassing. People in our country, that is impolite. They said, what's impolite about that? They said, we're just showing interest in you. Well, I said, we think, mind your own business, it's none of your concern. But it is our concern, they say. We're interested in you, we want to know what you do. So you see, different people have a different perspective. India and in Nepal, kissing in public is something that's frowned upon. I was in Nepal with a local Nepalese Christian, and there happened to be a couple of tourists. This was in Kathmandu, and they were just having a kiss. It wasn't a big passionate job, there wasn't even a big hug, but there they were on the street and they're having a kiss. And this Nepalese man, he said, look at them, they're like animals. I was a bit taken aback and I said, I've never seen animals kiss. No, he said, that he went on, and of course kissing is linked with copulation. So he was saying, they're just like animals, do anything in public. And I said, well, it's not really all that bad. They might have thought before they did something, but you know, it's no big deal. I said, I've been here in Kathmandu for the last week. I said, every time I go out, I see men urinating against a wall, against a tree in a public place. He said, what's wrong with that? He didn't see anything wrong with that, but he saw something wrong with another thing that we didn't see anything wrong with. Well, so it can go on. But don't make the mistake of approving everything simply by saying it's their culture, or let them say it's our culture. There may be issues such as those that I've mentioned that are neither here nor there. There is no big deal concerning moral questions. But there are some things where I simply won't conform, and that happens even in Australia. I remember in Thailand, they go through your house, they'd walk through, have a look. They're not worried about what might be your private room. See, they're not worried about that kind of thing. They're showing interest. So they march into the rooms, and one of them said one day, "Hey, that room, you've got your bed in the wrong direction." This was not a Christian person, incidentally, because the bed was oriented north-south instead of east-west, or vice versa, I can't recall. I said, "What's wrong with that?" Oh, he said, "We'd never have our beds oriented that way because that is the way that the graves are set out in the cemeteries." This person was of Chinese extraction, Thai, but of Chinese extraction. The Chinese bury, whereas the Thais just cremate and do what they want to do with the ashes. But in the cemeteries, the graves are oriented in a certain way, and so it's bad luck to orient your bed in the same way. So make sure it is not, otherwise you're putting a curse on yourself. You say, "Well, that's a bit weird." But I've met Australians who are superstitious. I've met Australians who won't walk under a ladder. I've met Australians who won't put up an umbrella inside a house because it's going to bring bad luck. I've met Australians who, when you sneeze, they say, "Oh, bless you, oh, bless you." What on earth is going on here? Superstitious practices releasing you from a curse or something. The world will fall in if you don't do it. One of the things I've found is be very careful in these countries what you do with your fingers. Always be careful what you do with your fingers, your hands. In our own country, for example, we're well aware that certain usages of your fingers can be rude or crude. In other countries, they use their fingers in different ways. And some of the ways we use our fingers that are not crude, they would think are crude, and vice versa. Feet, toes, head, touching people's head, keeping your feet out of the way so that you don't sit with your toes pointing at somebody else. These are all hang-ups that Thai people have, and I've found comparable things in other countries. As I say, you ask or hang back and see what the locals are doing. None of those things are right or wrong in themselves. So you may as well just conform. There's no Christian principle involved. Just do what is culturally acceptable. I think of the way we eat. All people have different ways of eating. You hold your knife and fork in one way. We were taught this is the way you hold a knife, this is the way you hold a fork. When we went to school, this is the way you hold a pencil. Then I woke up one day and found that these are not things that are in the genes of the human being, as if there is a right way to hold a pencil and everything else is wrong. I see people holding pencils in all sorts of weird ways, and yet they seem to be able to write quite legibly. What's it matter? There is no Christian way of holding a pencil. There is no divinely given method in the human makeup saying this is the way you must hold a spoon. All of those things are culturally governed. They're acquired. They are not in our genes. So when we go to places, we have to be flexible in those things. But let me come to what was probably the biggest culture shock. And I got this, not necessarily in Thailand, because Thailand was a fairly tough country, and it still is, a very tough country to see church growth. The converts come slowly, and after much expenditure of energy, time, prayer, and effort. You go to other countries, especially some of the countries of Africa, and you see vibrant, growing churches such as I've never seen before. There's a whole atmosphere in the church and in society which is helping to produce growing churches. Now, the countries might be clapped out. They might be governed badly and have all sorts of hardships and difficulties through natural disasters, wars, famines, mismanagement, corruption, disease, poor services, a whole range of issues that create unsatisfactory life for many citizens. And yet, they are better at evangelism than we are. They are better at prayer than we are. I have learnt more about true Christianity from people in these countries than I ever learnt from my own country here. I go to these countries to teach, because that's what I do, I teach the Bible, but I come away invariably having learnt more than I taught. Learnt more about discipleship, more about commitment, more about prayer, about giving, about all these fruits of the Spirit that are talked about and the characteristics of the Christian life, and to see these things. to see them out there evangelism and see these churches bursting with growth. Now, when I come home and tell people, sometimes they won't believe it. They think that I'm exaggerating, because we have become so accustomed in this country to a fairly nebulous kind of Christianity and a very apathetic attitude in the church towards church growth, Bible teaching, or what have you. And so this is also a cultural shock now, but it's a cultural shock with a difference. Let me talk about Burundi. When I visited there, the first time I came in contact with that country, when I first visited there, I found their growth was something amazing. It was about the second poorest country in the world at that stage. There were no missionaries there. The missionaries had all left sometime earlier. There had been missionaries there during the 40s and 50s. But now these local Christians were carrying things on. They had about 45 churches, and I was there a couple of years later, and they then had about 65. And then I was there a bit later, and they had 90. And then you get reports later, and they've got 120. They're multiplying at a rate of about 20% per year. That's enormous growth. And these are not small churches. The average size is 400. The biggest are 1,000 up to 2,000, and then the smallest are starting with a bunch of converts, maybe 20 or 30, and very soon they've got up to 50 or 60, and so they're growing. They're also running some institutions that were left behind by the missionaries, but they're not funded from outside. The locals are running them. They have a clinic, a school for the deaf, a school for the blind. They have Emmaus correspondence courses with over 2,000 students. They have a local Bible school that runs for a certain number of months a year. They teach Bible in schools, what we call religious education or religious instruction. They have 250 volunteers giving 2 hours every week. Can you believe it? You're flat out getting any volunteers here to give 2 hours a week. 250 just in the capital city alone. It's not a very big city, Bujumbura. Nobody knows the exact size, but I would think somewhere between 50 and 100,000, that's about it. They've got to do income generation, running a little kiosk along the street just to sell bits and pieces and get a little bit of money to help maintain their ministries. Someone else has a maize grinder. People can come and grind their maize for a nominal fee that not only helps the food supply, but also generates a bit of income. Malawi, another poor country. To see the way the people there are outreaching the poor, always helping the poor. Orphanages, or even people taking orphans into their home. In Zambia, I came across a case where, I can't give you the exact statistics off the top of my head, but something like 70-odd Christian families had taken in around about 170 orphans, 2 to 3 per household, and looking after them. No government money supply, no welfare benefits or anything like that in these countries. No wonder the churches are growing. Ethiopia, I've told stories before, you may have heard about some of the innovative outreach activities, dividing the district up into X number of divisions, and then dividing the church members up into the same number of divisions and allocating 50 houses or 70 houses or 30 houses or whatever it is to each of these units in the church. Get out there, help these people. Help them with education, because only about a third of all the children in Africa are in school because people can't afford to pay the fees. The idea of free education is something that is unheard of in many countries of the world. And so the Christians are going out to help literacy. They're helping with some repairs to the house, put on a plastic covering over the roof to stop the rain getting in, or help people with basic medical services. No wonder the churches are growing. In Uganda, to see these fellows reaching out to Muslims, they get very angry because there are so many Muslims coming into the country from Pakistan and Saudi Arabia as evangelists. And so what do these local Ugandan Christians do? They don't just sit there and complain about it. They go up and meet these people and say, what are you doing here? This is a Christian country. Why are you coming? So they challenge them. One fellow said he challenged one of these people to a debate in a public place. Now, you couldn't do this kind of thing in some of the more aggressively Islamic countries. So he challenged this fellow to a public debate. So all the people come around. At the end, he said there were some made decisions for Christ. I thought, goodness me, the strange things you see. You couldn't imagine this happening in some places. The baptisms, the number of baptisms they had in Burma, Myanmar, the church in the centre of Yangon there, which struggled all the years that we were in Thailand. Some of our missionaries used to go across every now and again and see if they could give them a bit of encouragement. But you could only get in the country for 3 days in those times. I'm back in the 60s, 70s, 80s. But then things did open up a bit during the 90s, and we were able to go in there, and we've got quite a big involvement in Myanmar. But that struggling church grew to 600, and then it started planting daughter churches. It now has 80 or 90 daughter churches. The central church still has about the same number, 600. Every month, on the second Sunday of every month, there are baptisms. Now, the last time I was there happened to be a second Sunday of the month, and there were baptisms, and they baptized 14. I said, how many do you normally baptize? And he said, oh, about this. Sometimes you might have 25, sometimes only 6 or 7. But that's the way the church is growing. They put them all through training programs, discipling them for a certain number of weeks, put them through a course before they baptize them. This has been going on now year after year after year. The second Sunday of every month, of every year, all the way through, baptisms taking place. And out in the front, right out in the front, where everybody walking up and down the street can see them. It's an open air kind of a thing. Ethiopia, the growth taking place there. We have contact with a man there who is really a kind of secretary for Christian assemblies. And each year he sends me a report. Now, the last one I got, the number of churches had grown from 60 to 80. The number they baptized in the last year was more than 1,000. The number they graduated from a Bible school they've set up was 35. So these will go back to be elders in their churches. I could go on with story after story of these things. Now, when I tell these kinds of things to people in Australia, many people think I'm exaggerating. They simply cannot get their heads around the fact that this growth is taking place. We used to talk about how can Christianity work in another culture. And then I came to the realization that we are the other culture. Our culture is further removed from the Bible than many of these other cultures in countries that I speak of. And when we look at the greed and self-indulgence that dominates in our Western society, we realize that we are very much another culture in relation to the sort of life that Jesus taught his disciples to have. The problem is that people here don't realize it. Now, there are many good things that our governments do for us. I don't want to say that the whole of our country is shot to pieces. For example, we have a democratic system that means you can change governments through a system that is fair. I'm not saying democracy will deliver you the best government, but I will say that it will not allow a bad government to stay there forever. If you have a fair system in place, then the government will change. And when it changes, it's a not very gentlemanly affair. Half the population think it was a good idea and the other half don't think it was a good idea. But we don't have riots in the streets. We don't have bloodshed. We don't have people burning down buildings or blowing up buses. In a lot of countries, the only way you can change the government is through violence. Sometimes they have elections, but to win an election is quite a different thing from winning government. We think of other things we have in this country that are beneficial, like medical services, hospital services that are available to all. Pharmaceutical benefit scheme that means medicine is affordable for everybody. An education system where every child is entitled to government-funded education. We have government welfare programs. We have aid for the disabled. There are family benefits, there are child benefits. There is aid for those who are disadvantaged. There is help given to the aged, to the unemployed, to all sorts of groups. So there are lots of good things in our society. But there are lots of bad things. Things that are far worse than what you might see in other countries. The sexual aberrations, the promotion of sexual aberrations in this country, which would never see the light of day in some of these other difficult countries of Africa and Asia that I've talked about, because the government wouldn't allow them. Especially in Africa, where there's a very pro-Christian ethos in the value systems that drive them, the sexual morality kind of thing, where governmental procedures are corrupt and mismanaged and bad, but in other ways they are far better than we are. But as I said, the problem is we don't see it. Which reminds me of the church in Laodicea, where the people were very much the way we are. They were rich, they were well dressed, they had everything in place, but in the eyes of the risen Christ, they were revolting. He says, you think you're great. You say you have prospered. You say you don't need anything, you're self-sufficient. But you don't realize that you are wretched and pitiable and poor and blind and naked. The risen Christ says, you think you're great in all your finery. As far as I'm concerned, you're in the nude. You're disgusting. You look awful. In fact, he says, you make me want to throw up. I will spew you out of my mouth. That was the very sanitized way it was put in ancient versions. You make me sick. That is really what the risen Christ is saying to that church in Laodicea, and I fear it may be what he would be saying to the church in Australia, because it seems to me that we have been swallowed up by our culture and we need to be shocked out of it. We need to see that this culture we live in is not a Christian culture. The values that drive our culture are a million miles removed from what Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount or in any other of his teaching. We must have radical change. Never mind about another culture in another country. How about working about how we're going to change our own culture? It's only going to change in you and me as we make a radical, decisive step not to conform to the practices and the tendencies of the culture in which we live. Cultural change. Culture shock with a difference.